All right. No, tell us.
Huh?
What do the stars represent?
Stars on the patch?
You put stars on this patch. It's a Southern Cross. It's in the sky. You know, up in the sky, Southern Cross. And the only place you can see it is down the South Pacific. So that's why they put it on this patch. The first division patch is the same, has the same thing on it. Only has a one with Guadalcanal on it. This was written by our second in command.
Griffin.
Yeah, Sam Griffith. And he was our CO on New Georgia.
Get some water if you need it.
Okay. Get cough drops.
Well, when you, Amy's going to start in a minute, but when you went down to the New York State Military Museum and they did the interview with you, it's going to basically be the same type of setup.
Yeah.
I know the guys who do the interviews. Of course, I can't think of his name right now.
Well, it's on that sheet. It's on that...
It's on the tape, yeah. Mike Russert. Or his friend, Bob. Anyway, we're going to cut this part out of the tape because it's going to go down there. So they won't know that. I don't know the name.
Now, you can see I wear hearing aids, so maybe you have to speak up a little bit.
Okay.
Like when I was doing with Mr. Leone.
Okay.
Speak up. Don't be shy.
All right.
And if you can't hear you, he's going to ask you again.
Okay.
When you get my age, you go through a few things like that. Amy told you what tomorrow is, didn't she?
It's his birthday.
Oh.
Tomorrow.
What's the date in history?
Tomorrow's December
7th. Oh,
Pearl Harbor. Well, 19th birthday, they bomb Pearl Harbor, so I have.
Okay, go ahead.
It's already recording.
Oh, all right.
You ready? Ready, wait for you.
My name's Amy Baumler, and I'm interviewing Mr. Robert Addison at Hudson Falls High School, December 6th, 2005. It's
quarter of three,
and we're ready to start. Of course, my first question is going to be, where were you on December 7th, 1941?
I was home celebrating my birthday with a few of my friends. It was a Sunday, and my youngest sister had gone to the movies, and when she came back, she said they stopped the movie and said they bombed Pearl Harbor. So that's when I heard about it. So we turned on the radio, no television in those days, turned on the radio, and that's about all you could hear. It was news. That's when news really got started. They didn't have daily news up until World War II. From then on, that's when they started having these daily news. So that's where I was.
How did you become a part of Edson's Raiders?
Well, let's go back. A month after the war started, I joined the Marine Corps, January 7th, 1942, and was sent down to Parris Island for boot camp. Well, prior to the war, boot camp had been 13 weeks, but they had to get a division. They had parts of a division. So they had to get a division ready quickly, so they cut boot camp to 6 weeks. And so you were supposed to spend 2 weeks of close order drill, 3 weeks on the rifle range, and then a week of extended order drill. Well, when it come close to time for us to fire the rifle range, wasn't any room down there because we were coming in 500 a day. So they just, after my close order drill, they gave us the week of extended order drill and put 500 of us on a train and shipped us up to Quantico to fire the rifle range. Now, it's a little cooler up in Quantico than it is down Parris Island, South Carolina, and we were up there in January and December, January and February, and it was pretty cool. In fact, I think it's the only time in the history of the Marine Corps on record day they called it off because the targets were flying out of the racks with the wind and stuff. But it was windy and cold, but anyway. And then when I just about ready to finish boot camp, they were filling up and forming this Raider Battalion. It had been what had been the 1st Battalion of the 5th Regiment of the Marine Corps. But they had taken it out and was making a special battalion out of it. And at this time is when they, when I was finishing boot camp, it was just about the time they made the name official of 1st Marine Raider Battalion. And so they were looking for a bunch of people to fill it up. And so they came out, they brought us in to their barracks and interviewed us. And then when we finished boot camp, then they just marched. My graduation boot camp was marching from the rifle range into the barracks and main base of Quantico to be part of the 1st Marine Raider Battalion. So that's how I got in. That was in about the 20th of February, 1942.
I was reading in the book by Alexander that when you were shipped off to Samoa, you didn't know at first where you were going when you went on the train. How did it feel to like not know where you were going
on the train? Well, we knew we were going to the West Coast. I was in what was called the rear echelon. In April, most of the battalion, well, let's back up. When I went in the battalion, I was in 81 millimeter mortars. Well, then they said, they're too big for the kind of operation we're going to be. So they did away with them. And because, you know, the base plate weighs about, I don't know, 80 pounds. And we just wouldn't, they figured we'd probably go into jungles and swamps and stuff. And you just couldn't carry something like that through. So they did away with those. And our battalion was an oversized battalion. Most battalions have 3 rifle companies, a weapons company, and a headquarters company, which is about 750 men. But we had a 4th rifle company, so we had close to 900 men. And in April, most of the battalion, all the battalion except D Company, which hadn't fully formed yet, that was a rifle company, and the mortars, they'd done away with, we stayed behind in what they call the rear echelon. And they took off. They didn't know where they were going, really, when they got on the train, until they got down south and turned west, and they said, uh-oh, we're going to the West Coast. So, and what they did, then they shipped out of San Diego and went to Samoa, and they were in Samoa for 2 months,
hard training. You have a phone call?
And we were back, rear echelon, then when the rear echelon and dog company, D Company, got fully developed, then we left in June and did the same thing, five days across country, shipped out of San Diego, went to Samoa, and we had other troops with us, so we dropped them off at British Samoa, which is APIA, APIA, and then we went back to Pango Pango, where we got our rest of our troops and picked them up and went to New Caledonia. So that's, we're on the ocean 30 days.
What was it like? What was your training like? What was your training like?
You talking about boot camp or in the Raider Battalion?
Raider Battalion training.
Yeah, see, because boot camp to me was not much, because I found that playing high school football in Ohio was tougher than boot camp was. And when we got in the Raider Battalion, then we really got into the force. Well, we'd go out on a Saturday morning, we'd go on a 22-mile full pack force march, you know, in the morning, you know, and then give us liberty in the afternoon. But it wasn't something, as I say, my high school football prepared me for being all this rough. And Edson was known for getting people in good physical condition. And he was the type of guy that you would go you would follow him any place. Because what he would do when we were on these force marches, he would stop. He'd watch everybody go by. And then he'd get on his walkie-talkie. And he'd hold up and he'd double time up. Start off, and when we came in, just around the barracks, he would stand there and watch every man go by and give him compliments to us, you know, good job, good job. And that's the type of leader he was. And he just, you know, and everybody practically worshipped him. He was quite a leader.
You said you were 30 days out to sea. Were you on what was called an Abel Peter dog?
A what?
An Abel Peter dog? Ship? An APD?
Oh, not going, no, APDs were auxiliary patrol destroyers.
Okay.
And what they were World War I destroyers, four stacks. And what they had done, they had taken the old engines out and put diesels in. And that made room for 150 troops. So they assigned those ships to us to travel on. But going when overseas, we went overseas on a regular transport. And the APDs got caught up to us on New Caledonia. But there were only four of them at that point. So when we left New Caledonia, there were only four of them, so they couldn't take the whole battalion. And I was on guard duty up on a ridge. And this one, we'd been practicing, going ashore and going back and forth. And all of a sudden, I look up and there they went. I said, gee, there I am, left behind again. But they just didn't have room. And so they waylaid a New Zealand. It had been kind of a cruise liner, you know. It had, but they had converted it and they called it a cruiser. It had a couple of 5-inch guns on it. And I guess it blew a couple of Jap subs out of the water because the Japs just thought it was one of these cruisers and they thought they'd surface and but anyway, it had brought a load of mutton up to New Caledonia from New Zealand. And so they went down and asked the guy and the Manawai, that was the name of the ship. The Manawai, that was the name of the ship. And went, well, I could take you up slowly. In the meantime, the rest of them had all congregated up near the Fijis to pull maneuvers prior to going into Kalagi Guadalcanal. And so he took us up there, and then we went aboard another transport, which was already filled up, so we had to sleep up on deck. And he wouldn't go the whole way, but no, they said, no, you're going back now. So anyway, that's the way we... That's those APDs, auxiliary patrol destroyers. That's right. But we didn't go overseas in them, but we used them when we left New Caledonia, and we used them to go from Tulagi to Guadalcanal down to Tasimboko and around like that.
Could you tell me about Tulagi?
Tulagi? Well, now, as I don't know if you've read about, but Tulagi was where the governor of the British Solomon Islands resided. See, they were under British control. And so the governor lived on this little island, about a half mile wide, about 3 miles long, and they had parade ground, polo field, big nice houses and everything. And of course the Japanese had taken over and the British government had left there. And so that's what, and when we went in, they didn't even know we were coming because they'd been shelling them and bombing them for a couple of days. And then early in the morning, they bombed and shelled them again, and we went ashore. Now, as it says, we were the first offensive ground troops to engage the Japanese. We went into Tulagi at 8 o'clock in the morning, and the rest of the division went into Guadalcanal at 9 o'clock. So we were the first. And so when we went ashore, and we were halfway down the island before they even knew we were there, and so it's a good thing they didn't know we were coming because the beach we went in on was coral and our landing craft couldn't even get to the beaches because of the coral. Then you had to get out and about 100 yards we had to wade in. And sometimes it'd be at our knee deep, sometimes it'd be up to here, depending on where the coral was. And if those landing craft had gone, they were just made out of wood, the landing craft, and it would have just riddled them, with that coral. So fortunately, there was not a defended beach there, and so we got ashore and above where their residents were, and then moved down the island before they knew we were here there, and as a result, they were in their caves. They had a lot of caves on there. They went into their caves, and you come across some of the places where they had lived, and their breakfast was still warm on the table, and they'd just taken off. Some of them weren't even dressed, and we didn't know it. We bypassed a lot of them, and then they came out at night. The first day, we couldn't even use our mortars. The first day, we had them in such a small pocket, we thought that we couldn't use the mortars because it'd probably injure some of our own people. So that was a little island, Tulagi. That was across Sea Lark Channel, right in the cove of Florida Island. There was a good harbor there, and it was a Jap sub base. It made a Japanese submarine base out of it there. It was a nice, deep harbor.
So the Japanese came out at night, like the way that it happened?
Oh, yeah. They like to fight at night, see? Psychological thing, because they thought, oh, well, gee, they could see, but it didn't take us long to find out. They couldn't see any better at night than we could. And so after that first night, and then later on the Guadalcanal up in New Georgia, if we were pushing them, we would withdraw a little bit at night, and they'd come looking for us, and a lot of times they couldn't find us, you know, because they couldn't see. But it was psychological, you know. Now, you got to remember, now, these Japanese had never suffered defeat any place. You know, they'd been in Korea, they'd been in all the way down the southeastern mainland peninsula, the Philippines, Guam, Wake. They never been beaten. And so they just thought they were invincible, but they weren't.
After Tulagi, you went to Guadalcanal. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
You have a phone call.
Yeah,
Joey,
well,
Turney,
after we took Tulagi, we were there until close to the end of the month. Now prior to going over to Guadalcanal, remember that one picture I showed you of what they left behind at the Teneru? Mm-hmm. Well, on Guadalcanal, all we had was a perimeter defense, a small area around Henderson Airfield. I don't know if you can see it on there. It's just a small area, perimeter defense around the airfield. That's all we have of Guadalcanal. And as you're looking at that, to the right, I don't know if the Teneru is on there or not, but anyway, the Japs, they could land anytime they wanted to. And they did. They landed troops, and with 1,000 men, they tried to take the airstrip back again. Well, the Marines sucked them into a trap and annihilated them, all but about 20 or 30 of them. And now, let's back up a little bit and go back to Tulagi. 2 days after we landed, August 9th, there was a big sea battle around Savo. I don't know if you see Savo, it's up in there. See those things down there with one, number one, two, three, and four, or five on them? Those squares out in the channel?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
No, they're up between the two. They'll come up this way. And I'm sorry. But anyway, here's Savoie. See, Tulagi's right here in Guadalcanal. Here's all we have in the airstrip. That's all of the Guadalcanal. But anyway, around the Savoie Island, there was this huge sea battle. And we lost four cruisers that night. And so our fleet, that was the aircraft carriers, all the destroyers, cruisers, battleships, and our supply ships, the troop ships, took off, went back to New Caledonia, took most of our supplies with us. So we were left there with practically no supplies. We had to subside on Japanese rice, and for several weeks, that's about all we ate, was Japanese rice once a day. And because they had, you know, we took some with us, you know, for about two or three days on our pack, but once they were gone, that we had to rely on the Japanese rice for it. And so that's why they could land any place. We had no protection. In fact, when Sea Lark Channel, there was a fellow by the name of Reveille Joe, was a destroyer. He'd come and cruise up and down between Tulagi and Guadalcanal and loft a few shells here and there, you know, some over Tulagi, some over to Guadalcanal, just to harass you. And so that was one, Reveille Joe. And we had Louis Lelaus, Worship King Charlie, Pistol Pete. I should tell about those later.
Were they ships?
No. Reveille Joe was. He was a Jap can destroyer. Pistol Pete was a piece of artillery up in the hills. They used to shell us. When they had bombed, they would shell us at the same time. It took us a while to realize it. See, there's a difference between a bomb dropping and a shell coming in. A bomb is like a whistling sound, and artillery is kind of whoosh, 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 you know. We'd be in our bunker, we'd hear that whoosh. That's not bombs. So we found out it was a Pistol Pete up in the hills. And then Washing Machine Charlie or Louis DeLisle, he was just a small plane that would come over and drop small bombs, you know, just to harass us so we would get some sleep. So that's what those guys were.
Did support ever come back?
Hmm?
You said that they left. Did they ever come back?
Oh, yeah, they eventually got back, yes. And, well, you've studied the Battle of Midway, haven't you?
I don't think so.
Midway, yeah.
Midway? Oh, yeah.
Midway, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, see, that was a turning point in the sea, because they lost, what, four aircraft carriers? And so they didn't have the protection for their fleets at that point, air conduct. And so after that, then after this Battle of Savo, then our ships finally got back, and they didn't, well, it was in the latter part of September. When they finally did get back and brought more troops in October, and said, no, the 7th Marines came in Samoa in September, and they're the ones that brought another rifle. Now, do you know anything about rifles or anything? Well, they're listed at the top there.
Okay.
They are. The first one up there, you see it, the Springfield 03?
Yep.
That is a World War I rifle. That's the rifle I carry all the way through Guadalcanal.
Really?
And then you go on down and there's a Grand or an M1 partner.
Oh, yep.
Okay, now that's a semi-automatic. In other words, you could push one and pull another one, you know. It's not like a machine gun where you pull a trigger and, you know, like that.
Right.
You have to pull each one. But with the 03, you had to work a bolt to shoot, you know, push another one in. So the 7th Marines in October, September, brought the M1 on. That was a little surprise to the Japs too, because they were used to our guys having to work the bolt. They'd get up and toss a pineapple at you. But when they get up and dug, well, the 7th Marines would pick them off. So that's antiquated weapons that is what we had. And the biggest weapon we had was a 60-millimeter mortar. That was the biggest. And our machine guns were air-cooled. They were the light air-cooled machine guns, not the big, heavy, water-cooled.
Were there any memorable personal experiences on Guadalcanal for you? Like?
Well, As I tell it, remember, I said we had about 900 people on our battalion, but we were in existence only 2 years, and in 2 years, 2,400 guys went through the battalion. So we had a few casualties here and there. And after Tulagi, Guadalcanal, and then later on New Georgia, of the original 900, there were 200 of us left. And there's another fellow who's down in Fort Edward, Jerry West, neither one of us got wounded at all. And now, close calls, sure. When we left, back and we left Tulagi and went over to Guadalcanal, we were on one of these APDs, the Calhoun. And it was in the afternoon, and we got over to Guadalcanal, and they were debating whether to leave us aboard ship and take us ashore in the morning or take us ashore then. So they decided to take us ashore. And before we hit the beach, there was an air raid, and the ship was sunk. 2 minutes it went down, that was it. So I figured that was a kind of a close call for me. And later on, another one I can remember as close was on the Battle of Bloody Ridge. The last morning, they had a range on that ridge of their knee mortars and machine guns. These knee mortars are like a large hand grenade. And I was up there, and one came right at me, and lit within 2 feet of me, and rolled down the hill, never went off. So that's, and there were, of course, there were many, many other, I'm sure, other incidents when, you know, you'd see tracers going, Well, let's see. A tracer here, I don't know if you know what a tracer is. It's when a machine gun fires, well, they have tracers in them. About every seventh bullet is one you can see. Well, in between there is about six or seven others. And you say, gee, you can see the tracers. Where are the rest of them, you know? And they would be hitting trees above you and that kind of stuff. And, so they're, no. So anyway, they're... Now, what was your question?
Oh, before? Memorable experiences for you, like...
Well, those are some of the experiences I had. And of course, the food. You had a question on there about food. Well, as I say, we ate chop rice for a long time, and we finally got food came in. Well, it was mainly dehydrated potatoes, dehydrated milk, Spam, Vienna sausage, and corn, we call it corn willy, big cans of corned beef, stringy stuff, you know. That was our diet, so it took me a long time before I could eat rice or corned beef. After I got back.
Could you tell me a little bit more about Bloody Ridge?
Bloody Ridge, okay. Well, we knew they were land after we went over the Guadalcanal. And we knew they were landing, and there was a village called Tasabuco. That would be down to your right.
Down over here?
Yeah. And it was a village, and of course there were no natives there. The Japs had drawn them all up into the hills. And so after we went down and we went aboard our APDs, and we only had two or three of them by then. And then we went down on some other, what they called banana boats. I don't know. They were, and anyway, we had to go down in two shifts, one evening, and then the rest of us came down in the morning and went ashore and to pull a raid down there because we knew they were there. Well, prior to our landing, the main force had moved back up into the jungles. And I think it was probably about 3,500 of them. But they left four pieces of artillery there, which they were going to use on us when they attacked us. So we destroyed the artillery. We pulled it out to sea. We blew up an ammunition dump. We destroyed the food that we couldn't carry back with us. And they had bicycles and everything there. And so... Then we did all that stuff and got back aboard ship and went back up, and we got into that perimeter defense. There was a spot on this longer ridge that wasn't covered. So that's where we were, because Colonel Edson, he had served in China before the war, so he knew these Japs. And in fact, sometimes he knew what they were going to do before they did. And he just knew that that was where they were going to attack. And he finally convinced General Vandegrift that that's where we should set up our defense. And he did. And that's where they attacked. 3,500 of them attacked 700 of us on that ridge. And it was two nights a day. Nights. They fought at night. And we would have support. We would have, not patrols, but listening posts out around. You know, a couple of them got overrun. I was out on one. Fortunately, they didn't come. You know, there's Jerry West, who lives down outside of Fort Edward. He said after our book came out, he said he couldn't sleep for two nights because he found out that he was on an outpost out there and a whole battalion of Japanese passed within 100 yards of him. He didn't even know it until he read the book. So, and when I was out on this outpost, you would stand guard. You would never stand guard by yourself because your imagination could do a lot of things with you, always two of you. A fellow was with me, he was approaching, daylight was coming, and he says, I hear something. And I said, well, good. And we had to stand watch with our bayonets fixed because over in Tulagi, the first night, everybody was shooting, boom, 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 you know, they just, and the word came down, fix bayonets. If you see somebody, we want to see blood the next day on your bayonet. So that's why they said you had to stand watch with your bayonets fixed. And So we were with bandits fixed, and this guy kept saying, is somebody coming? Is somebody coming? Somebody coming? And I tried to be a little, I was always optimistic. I never thought it was as bad as they tried to tell us it was. But anyway, and finally he says, I'm going to get him. And so he'd lunge and you feel me? Well, when it did get a little lighter, it took about a half hour to dig his bayonet out of the tree and he stuck, so he was one of those. But prior to our going over there, this Battle of Teneriffa, they tried to take it back with 1,000 men. And I said, these were guys who had never lost before, and so they thought they were invincible, but the Marines just sucked them in and killed over about 20 of them. So that was the first time. It's just through the stupidity of the Japanese that they did not take the airstrip back, because they tried to take it back in one, up from one air with 1,000 men. They tried to take it back on Bloody Ridge with 3,500. And then later on, up at the Matanikau, up the other way, they tried to take it back up there. If they would have waited and attacked from all three spots at the same time, there's no way we could have defended them. We just didn't have the personnel there to do it with. But, so that was it. And they left about 1,400 of them, that you saw the picture of in that book, what they left behind. We had about 50% casualties, not all killed, but about 50% casualties that was two nights. And then we came off of the ridge, and it was in the Coconut Grove, that's where our bivouac area was. And then they needed us up at the Matanikau the other way. And now in the meantime, our colonel, see, a battalion commander is a lieutenant colonel. Well, he had made full colonel. And so after Bloody Ridge, well, then they made him the commander of the 5th Regiment. See, you have battalions, and then you have regiments, and then divisions. Well, he was made the commander. CO of the 5th Regiment, and that's where they were, up at Matanikau. And we went up and tried to do it. We were unsuccessful. And now, on the Battle of Bloody Ridge, two of our members received a Congressional Medal of Honor for that night, Colonel Edson and Major Bailey. Well, up at the Matanikau, Major Bailey, like all of our officers, they weren't to say, you go here, you go there, and then follow me. And so he was leading, and he got killed up there at the Matanikau. And our second in command, who was then took over, Griffith, he was wounded that night, that day too. So then when we came back from the Matanikau, well, we were in this Coconut Grove, and they say, okay, there were, a little over 300 of us left then. And they said, all right, you're the reserves of the reserves. You won't be called out unless the island's in danger of being taken. So, 2 days later, A and C companies putting their gear. Where are they going? Well, Edson wants them to come up and guard your CP. Okay. So, next morning, put your gear, where are we going? Well, they had to use A and C company last night, so we're going up and guard the CP. Fortunately, that's all we did do. But our A company mortar squad was digging in up there at the Matanikau. And there were some Japs on our side of the Matanikau. They were on the other side, we were on one side, but some of them had gotten over, and they were trying to get back to their own men before the tide came in. They could go across the foot, the mouth of the river. And they ran into our A Company mortar squad section, and we could hear it. And Edson was going nuts because he thought they were coming the other way. He says, you're telling me, you gotta hold. But what it was, they were trying to get back and ran into them, and our guys were digging in, and there were no shots. The next day we found 9 of our Marines, there were 60 Japs who were dead from that hand-to-hand. So that's, and about 5 days later, we left the island. Those guys were that close to leaving the island, but they just didn't make it. And they brought in some army, and then we left in October. So, that answer your question?
Yeah. Did you have any, close contact with Japanese soldiers or anything like that? Like, did you take any prisoners or have any hand-to-hand combat?
I did not have any hand-to-hand. And we took very, very few prisoners. On Tulagi, they went in these caves and they wouldn't come out, so they would seal them up. Forget about them, you know, and they wouldn't come out and surrender. And I think a few of them surrendered, but not to us, other people that come on the island. When we went on the island, we had pieces of burlap on our helmets painted green. Our faces were blackened. For why, we don't know, but they were, and they knew who we were, you know. The reason for the burlap was to break that, you know, the helmet was round, and so this would give you a little more, whatever, camouflage. And a couple of them did surrender to somebody else, and they said, don't let the man with the socks on their hat scare us. So they didn't want to surrender to them. And they just didn't bother, you know. And we took very, very few prisoners. And on the ridge, we didn't take any prisoners because they took back off into the jungles again. And they called it, you know, the Hell Island, the Japanese, because they had to live out in the jungles. We were in the base, you know, and they lost, as you can see on there, 26,000 men. A lot of them died of starvation and diseases, you know, that they were had out. And when they finally left, well, they left 26,000 of them died.
Did you see the conditions of any of their camps, and compared to ours, were they the same or?
What was that?
The conditions of camps, like, did you see any Japanese camps, and compared to ours?
Oh, no, were they, no. Like, well, they didn't have any camps there.
Uh-huh.
No camps. Just at Tazabokan, that was a village. That was a native village, you know. No, we didn't see any camps at all, because they just lived in the jungle, and they never moved about.
What did the battalion do after Guadalcanal? Where were they sent?
All right. I say, when the army came in, there were about 3,000 army came in and relieved about 300 of us. That's what we had left. Of course, they weren't all killed, but they were, you know, left for sickness, wounded, whatever. And we went back to New Caledonia. We were there a little while, and just prior to Thanksgiving, there was a ship, a transport going down to Wellington, New Zealand, going to dry dock. And they say, okay, you can go down to New Zealand, stay as long as that ship stays in dry dock. And so we got down, we were out on the way down on Thanksgiving. Of course, they had prepared on the board ship a nice turkey dinner, but there were so many of us. By the time I got to mine, I had cold cuts. But it was still better than what they were eating up in Guadalcanal. And so we got down there shortly after Thanksgiving, and we spent holidays down in Wellington, New Zealand. And that was a memorable experience, too, because all we had to do was stand roll call at 8 o'clock in the morning. That's all they wanted us to do, stand roll call. But over Christmas, they gave us 3 days. We didn't have to come back for 3 days. So I went down to the local YMCA, and in their gymnasium, they had bunk beds set up, you know, to take care of servicemen and whatever. So I got myself a bed. And they would give you a breakfast, and it would cost you 2 and 6 for a bread and breakfast, 40 cents. And after I'd made arrangements, I came walking out of there, and some elderly lady stopped me on the street. She says, do you have a place to eat Christmas dinner tomorrow? And I says, no. Well, she says, would you like to come out to my house? I said, sure, fine. So she gave me the address and the phone number and says, if you got any other buddies, well, let them know. So I inquired around. Most everybody had something to do. So I called her. Okay, so she tell. Gave me the address, 12 Apuka Street, A-P-U-K-A. I still remember that. And her name was Lamberton, Mrs. Lamberton. She was probably in her late 60s, maybe early 70s. When we got out there, there were a couple other American sailors, a couple of New Zealand sailors. Her grandson was there, who later went in the New Zealand Royal Air Force. And we had a Christmas dinner out there, and that was my first experience with plum pudding. I was eating mine, and all of a sudden, clank, what? A piece of money. And I didn't say anything. It was a threepence. There was a penny, there was a threepence, a sixpence, a shilling, and a half crown, whatever, you know. And then somebody said, oh, I got a swing, I got this and that. So what they did, they put money in a pudding. I didn't know. So anyway, and I still got that thruppence at home. And we corresponded for several years after that. And so that was one experience. And then when I got back to New Caledonia, I got a letter from my younger brother. He's about 16 months younger than I was. And I knew he'd gone in the Army. And so I got a letter from him, and he was in the 181st Army Engineers. And he said, in the letter, he said they spoke French where he was. He said, well, he's either got to be here in New Caledonia or up at the Hebrides. And one of the fellows in my outfit says, I think I saw that sign, 181st Engineers. So I got a day off and went into Noumea, which was the capital of New Caledonia. And I got in a truck. We all rode just in the truck. I got right over the cab, and I told the driver, now if I pound on a cab, let me off, will you? So, and sure enough, there was a sign, 181st Engineers pointing up. So I pounded on a cab, we stopped, and I was walking up the hill. Three trucks were coming down, and all of a sudden, one slammed on the brakes, and my brother was driving one of them. So we were together there for a few months, and he'd come out and see me, I couldn't see him. He came out one day, and we were gone. That's when we went back up to up to Guadalcanal for a little more training. In the meantime, we'd gotten in replacements to build back up to our 900. And so then from Guadalcanal, we got aboard ships on July 4th, 1943. We went up to New Georgia. Now, New Georgia, there was an airstrip there called Munda, and which they were using, which we had to get away from them. And but on the north side of the island, there were two supply bases up there called Enagai and Bairoko. And it was our job to go up and knock them out. And we did knock out Enagai, but we never did actually knock out Bairoko because we didn't have the weapons to do it with. And I figured my brother probably was there because the engineers, and they were building a road from after they'd secured the airstrip, Munda over to Bairoko. And I figured he was there, but I wasn't about to take off in the jungles looking for him. And he came out and we were gone. But after the war we got together, yes, he had been on Munda. And now we went up to New Georgia, we landed up at Rice Anchorage, away from Anagai. We were 5 days going through jungles and swamps, coming in behind the Japanese. They never figured we'd come that way, which we did, you know, be in the swamp anywhere from your knees to your armpits. And it was, and we surprised them. And it was a good thing we did because they had 4 6-inch guns there, but they couldn't turn them around and use them once they were pointing out to sea. They had brought them up from Singapore. Now, across the way, at Kolomangara, there were 10,000 Japs over there. And we could see planes. They could see us. We could see over there. It wasn't too far away. But what we would do, after we secured Enagai, we would take our landing craft, go down to where we had Rice Anchorage, and we'd be standing up in the boat. And we'd go down there and get supplies and start some fires. And then come back, we'd stay down, so they couldn't see it. We knew they were watching us. And so then, after that night, they'd come over and bomb down there. And we laughed, nobody down there, you know. So, but if they would have known, 10,000 of them over there, if they'd have known there was only a couple of Italians of us over there, they could have come over and wiped us out. But again, it was through there. And in that area, now, you remember hearing the story of John F. Kennedy, PT boats? Did you study that? Yeah.
No.
That's where he was, and he got rammed by a Jap destroyer, his PT boat. Well, he was in that area between North New Caledonia and Kolomangara. That's where he was, and that's where he got a bad back, one day we sent a patrol down towards Enagai, down Bairoko, and somebody got killed. and come back. And the next day, we knew they were doing something. We could hear them pounding and all this stuff, and there was a lot of activity between Barroco and Quillam and Guerra. And the next day, the Army had been building a road, and they walked in, nobody there. So they had left at that point. So that's, then we left, then, let's see, we had about 300 was left after Guadalcanal, and there were about 650 of us left after New Georgia. And I say, but of the original 900, there were only 200 of us. And then we went back to Guadalcanal, then back down to New Caledonia, and I came back to the States.
Could you tell me a little bit about Edson?
Edson? Well, I told you something. That he got his, once a legend. And it's all about Edson. And he had been down to Nicaragua, and he fought down there, the bandits and down in those jungles. That's where he learned his jungle warfare. And he got Gold War, Navy Cross, and everything down there. He served in China. But I say, he was a real leader. He was a little guy. He was probably about 5'6". And had his helmet on. It looked like it was always too big for him. And he was always right up front. After we came off of Bloody Ridge, he had bullet holes through his uniform. And but never
Mr.
got
Mr. Millington, please call me in office. Mr. Millington,
that was one thing he always wasn't too happy about. He never got a Purple Heart. But he had, I say, bullet holes. And this Major Bailey, the day after, when they came off the ridge, they were back talking to the general. And Major Bailey, he had been wounded on Tulagi and had gone to New Caledonia and then hitched a ride on a ship back up to Guadalcanal. He was there for that Battle of Bloody Ridge. And he had bullet holes through his helmet, nicked his head, everything else. So Colonel Edson and Major Bailey were talking to Vandegrift, and Vandegrift told him, and he had a bloody face and everything. He says, Ken, that was his first name, he says, you better go check out a new helmet. He says, hit bullet holes in the helmet. But he was one, unfortunately, he didn't make it up at the Botanical. But Edson, as I say, he was, the guys would follow him any place. You know, because that's just the way he was. He would encourage you. You could talk to him. And he was a leader, a real leader. And he retired as a major general. And there's a slip there that says how many, what awards this battalion got. Four guys got the Congressional Medal of Honor, and there were many, many Navy crosses and all that stuff. And I think this comes to what that. No, that yeah, down at the bottom. What is it? 380 or 280 total?
321.
That's how many awards you can see. Navy crosses, all kinds of stuff. And seven fellows became generals. And that other sheet you just put down. There's 24 names of ships that are named after fellows from just one battalion. And they still say that this is probably the outstanding battalion the Marine Corps ever had. And then they say, well. And when I came back from overseas, people say, well, what's the difference between American servicemen and Japanese? I say, well, and it goes for the Germans too. We were taught to think for ourselves. And we could make decisions where they couldn't. Now, on the Battle of Bloody Ridge, they just pulled these bonsai attacks, you know, straight on, straight on, straight on. We had nothing to our left, nothing. If they'd have probed and probed, they could have surrounded us. But no, they go boom, 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 you know, this, and they couldn't think. And you haven't studied D-Day yet, I'm sure, in the history, have you?
Yeah.
Well, on D-Day, there were many, many cases of non-commissioned officers, junior officers, making major decisions. And yet there was a German general who had some tanks, and he knew what he had to do, but he couldn't do it because he didn't get orders from above. And Rommel was off for a birthday party for his wife, and Hitler was sleeping, and no way did you ever wake up Hitler, I guess. And so the poor guy, he knew what he had to do, but he couldn't do it. But if he'd American, he'd have done it. Because, you know, you got to make these decisions and do them, and that's the way we were taught to think for ourselves. And also, we were fighting to come home. We weren't fighting to be in honor for him, what he called the emperor or anything, you know. And there's a couple other things here. And as I say, I was no hero. I never got wounded, but I was where I was supposed to be, when I was supposed to be there, doing what I was supposed to be doing. And you weren't fighting for the United States, you weren't fighting for the Marine Corps, you were fighting for each other. Because, you know, if you didn't do what you were supposed to do, you were going to endanger somebody else. And they all felt the same way. You were fighting for each other. And then you talked about prisoners. There's a difference in the way prisoners were treated. You probably read about the Bataan Death March, you know, that thing. And I told you about these APDs. Well, another one of them got sunk. And after we had pulled we'd gone over, taken some of our guys over to Savo to make sure there were no Japs there. Well, our guys had just left that ship when there were some more sea ballots, Navy ships. Jap Navy ships came, and then this APD got sunk, and that Jap destroyer ran through these guys in the water and machine gunned them. That's the way they treated prisoners, you know, in the fort. And yet, when we left the island, there were some Japanese prisoners on this transport we got on. They had been picked up from one of the sea battles and then transferred to this and were taken back to New Caledonia or something. But they had clean sheets, clean blankets, pillowcases, pillows. All we had was a bare mattress to sleep on. And that's the way they treated the prisoners, you know. And they were down in a hole, because the hole was empty, you know, and that's where they fed them. Of course, we were up with, you know, watching them go. But they'd come out and bow, you know, and all this stuff. But because they know that they were being treated very nicely. That was a big difference between the way we treated prisoners. And of course, on our training, one reason why we were, you know, different, better than other Marine Corps units, from day one we went in, we were told, you are the best of the best. And so. And of course, I told you about our leadership. Our officers didn't say, you go here, you go there, follow me. And they went. And we had ingenuity, too. You know, we have a couple of cases. We were at Tulagi. The general he didn't get along. Our colonel didn't get along with the general anyway. But he was in one of these houses. And up on a hill, and of course, when Reveille Joe would come, his staff would wake him up maybe an hour before and come down and go into a cave, you know. Well, we were set up with our mortars to protect the beach in case they landed. And this one fellow by the name of Andy Dobie, he'd gone off watch, and we were there. He went into this cave, and he strung up a bunch of wires and tin cans and everything else, you know, in case somebody come in, they'd make a lot of noise and wake him up. Well, in come this general with his entourage, going right through this. They were mad. They read off poor Andy Dobie and ran him up to Colonel Edson, you know, and all that stuff. And I'm sure it was all Colonel Edson could do, keep from laughing right in the general's face. And later, he congratulated Andy on his ingenuity. And then we had another incident up on New Georgia. And this fellow by the name of Jinx Powers, he was a great singer. We was a singing outfit. I got a book of all our songs, you know, the cleaned up versions of them. But anyway, he was one of them. They had a group called the Eight Balls, which sang, and there they have some recorded our songs in the Library of Congress. But anyway, on New Georgia, he got wounded as we were coming in to try to take their Enagai, but he could walk. And so somebody said, Jinx, get back to the first aid station and tell them we can use some help out here. Well, he went the wrong way. Somehow he got mixed up and he went the wrong way and realized he was back in Jap territory. So, well, he says, they climb trees, so he climbed a tree. He was up in a tree, and so he was up there, I don't know, over about 2 days or something. And finally, some of our guys, Stu Polonis and a few others, are out looking for Jinx. And he could hear him coming, but he says, now if I yell at them, they're probably going to shoot me. So he started to sing Mamie Riley, the song Mamie Riley. And he said, oh, that's Jinx, let's go. So he used his ingenuity there. And of course, you had to use your sense of humor, too. You always couldn't lose your sense of humor. I remember when we were up on Garden Edson CP up at the Botanic, guys were saying, well, what are we going to do when we get back to the States? You know, well, we're going to train these other guys. And one guy says, well, I won't play unless I can use the Roman candles. That's what Japs used Roman candles to, you know, make believe they were firing at you, when to draw your fire. When they see where you are, then they shoot you. And then, of course, on Tulagi, we had a chaplain. He came around once and he says, you know, when I get out of this, he was from Chicago, he says, I'm going to get 100 raiders and paratroopers and go back and clean out the underworld of Chicago. So that's what it is. And we talk about our people who became generals. One of them became a four-star general, but became an assistant commandant of the Marine Corps, Lou Lowe. He was a captain when I was in the outfit. He was one of the four-star generals. Now communications, you know, anything going on in Iraq, instantly we know about it, right? Instantly. Well, we had what we call coast watchers. I don't know if you've told them about the coast watchers or not, but up the string of islands, called the Solomon Islands and on up, there were these Australian coast watchers. And they would relay messages when they would see Betty's airplanes, Jap airplanes coming our way, or ships coming down the slot. But to get the information to us, they had to send it to Australia, who sent it to Pearl Harbor, who Pearl Harbor had to send it to us. That's how we got information from them, which they were maybe 1,000 miles away or 100 miles away. And that's the way the communication was back in those days. And it took them 10, 15, 20 minutes for us to get that information. And now it's just like that, you know. I don't know, you got other questions or anything, but just Tokyo Rose, you remember what Tokyo Rose?
No, I don't think so.
Axis Sally? Mm-hmm. You haven't got those yet, huh? Well, Tokyo Rose was, she was a Japanese, but she was an American citizen, and she'd gone to Japan just for the war. And of course, when the war broke out, they grabbed her and said, no, you don't want anything to happen to your family, you'll do what we tell you to do. So she was propaganda, you know, and to us, you know. And she did us a favor twice. And she'd play all this music. Just think of these guys, you think of it, you fellas, you could be back home with your girls and, you know, all this kind of stuff. Well, she came out and said, the 1st Marine Raider Battalion has been annihilated on Guadalcanal. So we were permitted to write home and say where we were then, couldn't otherwise say. And when we got New Georgia, she did the same thing. 1st Marine Raider Battalion had been annihilated. So we could write home and say we were on New Georgia. Couldn't say where we'd been, but we could tell where. So there's other things. One time after our fleet had left us, then we were called the Marooned Division. Not the Marine Division, but the Marooned Division. We were all there.
Why were you called the Marooned Division?
Huh?
The Marooned Division?
Marooned. You know, we were just left to fence for ourselves and everything for a while. And then there was an epitaph that was on one of the Marines that got killed, PCFC Cameron on the cross on the cemetery in Guadalcanal. It says, and when he goes to heaven, to St. Peter, he will tell, another Marine burning, sir, I've served my time in hell. So, got other questions now, or what?
Do you have anything more you want to say about that? Do you have anything else written down?
Then I would use it with my presentation of all the maps and all that stuff I have and stuff.
Why did they let you write home?
Hmm?
After Tokyo Rose announced that they had annihilated, why all of a sudden would they let you write home, the Marine?
Well, we could write home, but we couldn't say where we were.
Okay.
Yeah, we could write home, we just couldn't say where we were. But then we could write. And when I came back, I remember my dad, he was working in the bowling alley. And of course, he'd have to go in, he'd work nights, you know, to get the bowling alleys ready for the next day. We lived in Alliance, and he worked in Canton, which was about 18 miles away. And he'd been early load sometimes, you know, and it was right after they got my first letter when I went overseas, this one from Guadalcanal. And there was some guy there complaining, oh, he can't get this because of the stupid war, you know, rations this, ration that. He says, here, read this. So he handed my letter to him. Never said another word. Says, you think you got it bad? What do you think of me? And here, read this. Well, I was telling him I was on Guadalcanal. So he said, never heard another word from him.
Just describing it?
Huh?
Describing your conditions and what you're living through? And...
No, just that I was on Guadalcanal, that's all.
Oh, okay.
Just there.
And he knew, just hearing the word Guadalcanal, probably what it was like.
Yeah. Of course, had any of you heard of Guadalcanal before you took this course?
Probably not.
See, the word Guadalcanal to me is just like you, Hudson Falls, Lynn's Falls, Queensbury, Fort Edward, you know, Guadalcanal, Tulagi, Tassamboco, Matanikal, Anakai, Baroque over there, all, you know, ingrained in me, and I'll never forget them. And it's like, you know, just like yesterday, over 63 years ago.
Did you know Jerry West when you were on Guadalcanal?
Oh yeah. Oh yeah, I knew him when I went in the outfit. He joined the Marine Corps before the war. So when I went in the outfit, he was a corporal.
Okay.
And yeah, oh yeah, we were both in 81 millimeter mortars, you know. And when we did away with that, then we went to demolition school. And I went overseas as a demolition. He stayed in it, but they had enough guys already in it, so I went back to A Company and E Company and 60 millimeter mortars. And I, recently I've been thinking, why was I put in the mortars and not a rifle company? And I know why. I was not a sharpshooter. I had never fired a weapon before I went to the Marine Corps and haven't fired one since. And that's the only time I ever fired was out of the Marine Corps. And I wasn't a sharpshooter, and so they didn't want me in a rifle company, so they put me in the mortars. So, but they liked my background of, you know, I was telling them how boot camp was not as rough to me as high school football out in Ohio. And I think this Major Bailey, the one I told, he was a captain then, he's the one that interviewed me. He played professional football with the Chicago Bears. And so I think that's why I got into Raiders, but I wasn't a sharpshooter, so they put me in mortars.
Amy, did you ask why the Raiders were disbanded?
No, I was getting to that, but...
Oh, I thought you were done.
No.
I didn't mean to take over your interview.
What was that?
I was going to ask a few things about the Raiders. I read in the book that it was controversial creating the Raiders, and I was wondering if you you were aware of the controversy.
What was that?
Like, were you aware of the controversy that creating the Raider Battalion?
Oh, yes, yes. At the time, no. And, most of the stuff I'm telling you, I found out afterwards. As I said, I was an optimist. I didn't believe them when they said how bad it was. It was so bad that Washington had told Vandegrift to surrender. That's how bad they thought it was. But he never told us.
Mm-hmm.
But later, as I started reading all this stuff, I found out they were not right. It was worse than they were trying to tell us it was. Because Vandegrift, in that do or die men, he states at the beginning there that if someone went to Marine Corps schools or any military course and was given this as a project, now what you need to go into here, and if they would have put down what the first division went in with, they would have flunked the course. Because we just didn't have He didn't have his whole division. He did. We had some of them were come up from New Zealand, some were in Australia, some were in Samoa, some was aboard ship still coming up when they made the decision that they had to take Guadalcanal. So they were all over the place. And the first time they got all together was when we went up to the Fijis. And that was a fiasco up at the Fijis. We just didn't know, nothing went right at all.
What happened at the Fijis?
Well, that's where we pulled maneuvers prior to going up to Thalagi and Guadalcanal. We pulled maneuvers and nothing worked. But it turned out all right. Because I said, it was what they call a shoestring operation. Because all the efforts were put in Europe at the time. You know.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, didn't get too along too well with MacArthur either. We had a name for him. Did you ever tell him what our name was? Right?
Was it Dugout Doug?
Dugout Doug, yeah. But it all worked out. I mean, the army that came on the canal, they did a very good job. Eventually, they did a very good job there.
What does Dugout Doug mean?
Hmm?
Like, how is it an insult calling
what?
Someone Dugout Doug?
Dugout Doug. Yeah, well, he was always back in the dugout someplace, not up front like our commanding officer or generals were. You know. And I don't know. You used to see pictures of him wading ashore, leading the troops, going back to the Philippines. Somebody's got to be ashore taking those pictures of him, you know. He was a great publicity man, but I mean, no, he was a great soldier. He was a great general. You just have this, you know. I always said, you know, the Army and the Navy, they were our allies also. So,
mm-hmm.
And of course, we technically were part of the Navy. Marines were part of the Navy because we couldn't go any place without the Navy. They had the transporters. They furnished medical men. We had no medical corps. We had our doctors and corpsmen, chaplains. And another great outfit in the Navy were the Seabees. They came on and finished that airstrip, you know. And it was that friend. And these APDs you're talking about, those guys just became like brothers to us, you know. They would send stuff ashore to us. And when you would stand there and watch this Jap destroyer going right through them after they'd sunk the ship, that made their guys kind of boil a little bit, you know, because they were like brothers to us, because you'd lived with them.
Despite the Raiders' fight record, they were disbanded. Do you know why?
The Raiders disbanded?
Yeah.
Well, technically we weren't disbanded. We were done away with, because as you moved out of the jungles, swampy areas, going north, there wasn't a call for that smaller type operation and fighting a jungle fighting. You were much bigger outfit. And so what they did, well, prior to World War II, when it broke out, the 4th Marine Regiment was in the Philippines and mostly Guam and around. Of course, they were annihilated, you know, not annihilated, but they lost their colors. And they just didn't want to form another 4th Regiment out of recruits. And so they were waiting. And so when they decided to do away with the Raiders, there were 4 Raider battalions by then. And Jimmy Roosevelt, who was President Roosevelt's son, was the CO of the 4th Marine Raider Battalion. He was adjutant to Carlson's 2nd Raiders. And those 4 Raider battalions, they decided to make the 4th Regiment. So they just stayed as the 4th Regiment, stayed out there. Now the paratroopers, they did disband them. I'm really going to talk. You know, there was no way you could parachute people in any place out there. So they fought with us. They took Gavudu and those two little islands there, Kanaboko, and then they fought with us on the Bloody Ridge, and then they left. Now they were a very small battalion, only about 300 and some. And I guess it was less than 100 of them left when they left the island before we did. And they eventually brought them all back to the States. That was after we came back, and just get away with the paratroopers. And I remember when I came back to the States, I was put on MP duty on the Camp Elliott, on the base, on the main gate. And I was there the night they came in with trucks and, oh, your turn next. And they no sooner hit the street and they were out the main gate, wanted to go across the street to the slop shoot with the beer joint. We looked at them, hey, you don't even look like Marines, you can't go up. Well, we just got to say, we told them, we came back and we went through the process. And then we got our uniforms squared away, and then we got leave, then we went home. So we went back, you know. And, but some of them did then finally get downtown San Diego, and they were, oh, they had their belt, their jackets this way, and their belts here, and their hat. Some of our guys were MPs down San Diego. They would come up to him and say, Mac, come on, straighten out, look like a Marine. We, oh, we just come back, okay, call the wagon, took away, you know. And that, none of them had ever seen combat. They were not any of the guys that fought with us. They were just guys that had gone over and they'd made paratroopers out of them. So, but our guys didn't have a use for them. Forget about it, you know. And we still get together every year. We have a reunion every year. And we've been getting together, go down to Quantico, where we formed. And this will be the 63rd anniversary, 64. We'll probably have one more after that, be the 65th. Because we're losing 15, 20. We lost 25 last year. I was one of the kids, I was 19.
Yeah.
So a lot of guys are gone. It's getting smaller and smaller. And two reasons why we're going to go maybe two more years. Now, one would be the 65th anniversary, and the other, they're building a big new Marine Corps Museum outside of Quantico. I don't know if anybody knows where Quantico is, but Route 95, old Route 1 was the old highway, which goes right through near Quantico. And to the west is 95. Well, between those two highways is where they're building this big museum. And it'll be finished, dedicated a year from now. And so we'll be there in April and hope to get up so we can go up and see that. So if there's whatever's left of us at that point. And, oh, it's funny, we had a reunion with a group of us from upstate. And it wasn't 2 months afterwards, one of them died, you know. Just, you know, it don't take much, you know. You don't hang on and are sickly for a while. You just, you know, you get our age, you just drop dead, I guess, or something, you know. So, any other?
I had one, but I forgot it.
Did you read any of those things I wrote?
Right here?
No, that thing you gave me to fill out.
Oh.
I don't know if there's anything on there you want me to comment about or anything.
What's a battle star?
What's what?
A battle star?
Battle star. Well, they could, for your, on your ribbons, you've seen the ribbons that, you know, and for every major battle, they give you a star. Now, we got a star for taking Tulagi, we got a star for defending Guadalcanal, we got a star for New Georgia, you know. And then, when we left Guadalcanal, we ran into a sea battle. Of course, we were commanding some guns on the ship, and so we got a credit for our battle letter.
What happened at the sea battle?
Well, it wasn't real. We didn't actually get engaged into it, but we ran into where it was, and then we took another route, and they had to decide whether to go to the sea battle or where the submarines were. So they chose the submarines, I guess, and we got through. And so it was one of those seven sea battles, you know, around Guadalcanal. And if you check, there are more Navy casualties than there are Marines on Guadalcanal because of all the ships. Remember the story of the Sullivan brothers, the five Sullivan brothers who went down on one ship?
Oh, mm-hmm.
That's where it went down, on Guadalcanal. That was where they decided that brothers no more concerned with each other. Could you imagine being parents? losing five sons all at once, boom.
Yeah.
A lot of the stuff you already have, one.
Yeah.
Is this the same thing you had before?
Thing, yep.
So I guess we're done.
Okay. Well, thanks, Mr. Anderson.
Thank you.
For this wonderful interview.
It's a good interview.
So, we'll look at any of this other stuff and then fly.
Okay.